Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, is professional film critic Sean Patrick. And joining us once again, one of our mainstays, Josh Adams. Welcome back.
Good morning. Good morning.
Visit us at IHateCritics.net, EveryonesACriticPodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle there is Critics Pod. Be sure to subscribe and like those social media platforms, because we will be doing giveaways, it looks like. We should be announcing one this week regarding Echo Boomers, the Michael Shannon movie we promoted last week. We'll be giving away those digital downloads next week. So subscribe there, like us, whatever you do on those platforms. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Alexa, YouTube. Subscribe to those shows. Rate and review those shows. We'll try to read the reviews on the air. I think there's another one. Ghana is the other one in India. So that's where you can find us. We're at patreon.com/criticspod. It's the best way to help support the podcast. We're going to be releasing a bonus Thanksgiving episode this year. I was going to say today, but I don't know when you're going to listen to this. but it is on our Patreon. It'll eventually become, maybe next year I'll put it out for the regular listeners. and then we have another one with I Spit on Your Grave, a big bonus episode, digesting that movie for fun.
Over Christmas.
Yeah. Sean's idea, not mine, just so you know, Josh.
Oh, no, that's okay. I've never seen Spit on Your Grave, so that would be an excellent one to listen to while I watch it, I'm sure.
We have to watch like 7 commentary tracks and just digest it from every angle. I guess Sean was challenged by a fan on Twitter, so we're going to
Actual producer of the recent re-release of the DVD of the original. So they're a producer of this, and they challenged me.
Awesome.
Wow.
Do they want to come on? That might not be a bad second half of the podcast, us digesting it and then bringing him on. I don't know. We'll see. We'll talk about it all later. It's all Patreon. So subscribe to that if you want some of that fun content. And then before we get going, obviously Josh is back to some news. Before we even get to that, I subscribed to another podcast on Patreon, and I didn't realize it, but they do shout-outs on this podcast, and I didn't, like, I do it all on the same account, but I get money from our Patreon, and then I subscribe out. So money comes in, and then I send money out. So they're almost unrelated on Patreon, but it's the same account. And it said Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast, and it went to comedian Jen Kirkman, and she texted me and said, hey, or not texted me, messaged me on Patreon, hey, do you want me to do your shout out as the podcast? And I was like, well, I feel bad because that could open up a can of worms and then everybody's going to want to promote their podcast on there. So I said, no, here's my name, whatever. But she went ahead and still promoted the podcast. So if for whatever reason you're a Jen Kirkman fan and you came and you're listening to the podcast for the first time, hopefully this is a good one. We'll find out. We don't know yet. But thank you.
The pressure has mounted. Thank you so much.
But thank you, Jen Kirkman, for plugging our podcast. I was not expecting that.
That's amazing. She's hilarious. She's completely hilarious. I follow her on Twitter.
Yeah, she's my absolute favorite comedian. So it was really exciting to just have the shout out in general. My son got a kick out of it too. For whatever reason, he loves her as well. He can actually. You know how you hear about kids doing stand-up of like, oh, I would do Bill Cosby's set or I'd redo whatever when, that, you know, I'm thinking of the only clean comic who happens to be a rapist. But, you know, they'd reenact it out. My son can redo Jen Kirkman's stuff. So it's kind of odd and weird. But hopefully he grows up and becomes a feminist. So that's the only good thing I can think out of that. Let's get to the news. Wonder Woman 84 is actually going to be on HBO the same day it's in the theater.
Yeah, that's weird. I guess that's a little weird. But HBO Max, I think they're struggling to get a foothold, and they really could use a boost, and this would definitely be one. People are going to get HBO Max just to see Wonder Woman 1984 at home. And I think that is a, I think that's huge. And the fact is, by the time that Wonder Woman 84 arrives, there are not going to be that many movie theaters open. So I imagine this choice was a choice made in desperation as much as anything else.
Yeah. What do you think, Josh?
Well, it was actually pretty shocking, but not necessarily shocking, not surprising, if that makes sense, because I wasn't sure that they would specifically target one platform, because you could get lots of money going in different places, but they're probably just mitigating at this point what their losses would be. And if I'm not mistaken, Warner Brothers and HBO and Time Magazine, they're all one conglomerate. Am I right about that?
I think so.
I don't have it in front of me, so maybe. Probably.
Yeah, I guess if you're going to take losses at the theater from not having it in there, then at least if a platform like HBO Max is struggling, per se, to get a lot of subscribers, this kind of mitigates their losses across all platforms. But I did see that they were going to try and release it in theaters same day. I really would love to see it in the theater, but I'm not sure if even the Davenport theater locally is going to be open at that time. I would be willing to take a singular risk myself to do that, but I'm not sure how many people across the country will do that. Whatever money they can make back on a movie that's been done for over a year and a half, I'm sure is just fine.
Yeah, I'm not ready to get in the theater yet. Just I can't afford to be away from work that long. Everybody, we were doing a Zoom chat with our friends last night, and everybody was talking about all the time off they have in December, and I have like literally one day off, and it's Christmas. there's just too much going on to be sick, and I know, Sean, you definitely don't want to get sick either. But
no, I'm high risk. I'm not going to take even for Wonder Woman. I'm not going to take that risk, and I just don't trust other people. I trust myself to be able to do this safely, but I don't trust other people.
Yeah, and the ventilation is not great in theaters, or at least seems like it could runs the risk of not being great, I guess. But by all means, you know, support your movies if you want to. Wear your mask.
They'll be fine. The movie theaters are going to be just fine. I know everybody's going doom and gloom over this announcement, but truly, movie theaters, once the vaccine is actually out there and people are able to return to a more normal type of life, movie theaters are going to be one of the things that bounce back faster than anything else, because people are going to be desperate to be out of there.
Right. And I agree. And I'm going to watch on HBO Max. I probably would have rented it for $30 or $40 too, if we had to, you know, Sean and I could have shared a rental or something.
I would have done that as well myself. I would have done anything to have seen it, you know, at home via premium fee, like Mulan, whatever the case may be. This is, you know, my most anticipated, still planning on coming out this year movie.
Yeah. And then, on kind of weird news, Francis Ford Coppola is editing Godfather 3 or something. It's like he's killing off
Michael. I've never heard this. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, there's going to be a re-release this year for the 30th anniversary with, I think they're going to kill him off at the end or something like that. Which I don't know if they did that originally or not. I can't remember. It's been a long time since I've seen Godfather 3. but yeah, he's doing something.
We've got a few more weeks before we see it again.
Yeah, so... I might just watch the new one instead if that's what happens.
This is great. Now, I've never seen Godfather 3, so you can watch the new one, tell me all about it and which version I should watch, or if I should just skip both of them, which would be just fine with me.
Well, I'd have to watch both of them to tell you, because it's been a long time since I've seen part three. And I've only seen it the one time, because it's not worthy of... I mean, it's not bad, but I mean, another thing I have against Godfather 3 is it's probably what cost Goodfellas the Best Picture nominee, or not nominee, the win, because they're split too many mob votes. We'll get to that later. Josh.
Yes, sir. That's a nice lead-in.
What have you, and let's kind of catch up with you. You mentioned a couple movies you've seen recently. Is there anything you want to talk about that you've seen?
Oh, sure. You know, I've been to the drive-in a couple of times this past year, like three separate times, actually. But some of the classics that I saw, Jaws, Jurassic Park, E.T., et cetera, that's beside the point. That's just fun nostalgia. But I did go see the Bill and Ted Face the Music and New Mutants double feature at the end of August, I think it was. And, I mean, both films were fine. I did strangely appreciate New Mutants better than Bill and Ted Face the Music. And it was a fine night at the drive-in, but nothing really blew me out of the water, that's for sure. I don't think that either of you were too effusive about either of these, if I remember correctly, as well. But
I've not seen New Mutants. So.
Neither have I.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, do you want me to withhold or shall I tell you all about it?
Go ahead.
Whatever you want.
Okay. I would love to hear it.
The New Mutants, as cobbled together as this was over the past two and a half years by the Disney-Fox transition and the switching from this being a possibly rated R complete horror film to something that's more palatable for younger audiences, you can tell that this has had a lot of hands on it. And not necessarily Josh Boone, the director's hands. He's the director of The Fault in Our Stars, for those people that are counting out there. I wasn't, but, you know, other people might care about that. And you can tell maybe why they hired him. He's got a particular eye for what teenagers might do or what they might talk about. And a lot of the film is mature teenager conversation, though. There's a lot of talk about mental illness in the film, and not just a same-sex relationship, which I wouldn't want to point out, but it is in a superhero film, so I think it is important to recognize that. But it's a mature for teenager superhero film relationship. Maisie Williams and the young actress that plays a character called Danny Moonstar in a relationship, and it just... It's actually special to me because it shows the same kind of specialness to that relationship that is not treated the same way in this genre. So to me, it was important to see that, and I just wanted to make a note of it. Beyond that, the horror elements per se aren't... It's not really a horror film, but it is darker. I did appreciate the nods to other X-Men properties. It's not prevalent. It's almost as if they're trying to make sure that this doesn't include too many references to other X-Men movies because this is a one-off. There's no post-credit scene or anything like that, which was originally planned. Overall, I was surprisingly happy with the result because it didn't suck, if that makes sense.
That's pretty on par with what Zach said, I think.
Yeah. Not sucking is not exactly what I would call a high bar, but after what we heard about this and all of the retooling that it did, it's pretty pleasing. I would put it on par with something like The Wolverine, you know, middling X-Men film quality.
Did you think Bill and Ted sucked?
No, it didn't suck to me. It was just, I wanted to say, like, lack of authenticity versus the other ones. And it's not that Alex Winter and Keanu Reeves aren't trying, because they can flip right back into these characters, and it made a lot of sense. But I think, you know what, it's the production design and the style of director Dean Pariseau. Now, you guys know what Galaxy Quest is, of course.
Yes.
And I saw a lot of Galaxy Quest in this movie, and sometimes that's a good thing. Like tongue-in-cheek type of humor. But then there's something about Galaxy Quest that I thought was a little fake, not necessarily the most professional quality of film. And I got that out of this, too. And maybe that's just a style preference. But I didn't laugh as hard as I expected to. And I don't know, some of it was just a little cheesy for me.
Yeah, it was pure nostalgia for me, and when I keep it at that level, I like it. You know, it's like, it's pizza rolls. It's not Chicago-style deep dish pizza.
And I think that's kind of similar to what Sean said, microwave nostalgia. So I don't know.
The Chochinos, yes, of movies. That's nice.
What else have you seen?
Oh man, I made a list of 20
that
things
you
want to
see,
that
you want to talk about.
Right. Of all of these, most of them were out of my catalog. But I did want to point out On the Rocks, which is an Apple Plus or whatever it is, that streaming service that they have. It's a Sofia Coppola movie, getting back to the Coppola family. And so you've got the wonderful team of Sofia Coppola and Bill Murray in the same movie. And then you had Rashida Jones, who I'm a big fan of. And it was important to see this. I didn't know it was coming out until I saw a trailer out of nowhere. And then it said, hey, this is streaming now. And so we kind of got on that and watched it. I was pleasantly surprised. It is really good to me and close to great. Yeah. Not necessarily on the same level as Lost in Translation, but there was a time about halfway through the movie, about three-fourths through the movie, where I thought of Bill Murray's performance as, this is Bill Murray's Oscar movie.
Yep.
Right here. This is where he wins an Oscar. Because he was so incredible. And the only complaint that I have is that the end of the film was slightly abrupt and didn't necessarily reflect how I felt about the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I think that.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Sean.
I love this movie. I think it's one of the best of the year.
I agree. And I think the scene with the cop might be the best scene of the year. Yeah. Okay. Let's get on to, unless there's anything else you want to talk about, Josh, we can move on to the show.
Nothing else new. The last time that I was on, we talked about Palm Springs, and that's pretty much the extent of movie films that I've seen other than Borat, and I'm sure you guys covered that ad nauseum.
Did you like it or not? Just quick.
I liked it, but pretty gross.
Yeah. Let's start with Run, Hulu original.
Yes, Run stars Sarah Paulson as a mother who has a daughter who has special needs. So she's disabled in a wheelchair, and she has cared for her entire life. But now her daughter is up there in age. She's gotten to a point where she's looking at going to college, and mom is a little bit concerned about this, about her daughter possibly moving away. And this begins to reveal some cracks in their relationship. Mom keeps not letting her daughter get the mail. She keeps other people from kind of interacting with her too much. She limits her amount of time that she can be online. The whole thing begins to kind of reveal a bit of a mystery surrounding the mother's motivation. So as the daughter slowly reveals those things, we get to the tension starts to build between them, and this big secret at the center of the film begins to be revealed. I think this movie is really good. I knew exactly where it was going. I knew exactly what. I was not surprised at all by that. What surprised me, though, was the director's ability to continue to create tension even after you've really figured out what's going to take place. And that's really an effective piece of direction. And this is the same director who did Searching, Agnieszka Chiganti. Really, really great job of directing this film. He creates some really amazing set pieces of that are filled with tension, even if you know what's coming, even if you know how it's going to turn out, you still can feel this movie, and I really appreciate that. I think this is a really fun movie. It's a really exciting movie. It's got two really great lead performances, and I was really impressed, and I wasn't expecting to be.
Before we get going too far, you cut out just very briefly on my end. What was the name of the director, and what else did he do? That's the only thing I missed.
Searching, with John Cho.
Okay, that's right. That was a great movie.
Agnieszka Chiganti.
Yes. I saw Run as well. I agree completely. They take a very predictable, you know where it's going the whole time and find a way to make it intense. And this would have played great in a theater. It sucks that it wasn't there. I mean, that's all. You know, I feel weird watching Sarah Paulson on TV.
Scene, especially, I thought.
Well, go ahead.
Say that again. Sorry, you cut out on me. Well, you cut out when you said something about Sarah Paulson.
I like watching her on TV. Make I, I I like the separation, you know, with the American Horror Story stuff and that Netflix show that I started and didn't get any further on, the Ratchet or whatever. I like her. She's a great actress, but there's like the TV Sarah Paul. I'd like to see it on the big screen, and I think it would have made for a more fun experience. I did enjoy it, though. It was really well made.
That scene on the roof is one of the better scenes of the year, too. I have to say, I thought the tension of that scene was fantastic. I thought the action of that scene was really incredibly well staged and well shot. The choices that they make and how they frame that scene is really, really solid. And yeah, the wonderful thing about this movie is the ability to create tension when you didn't think there would be an ability to do so. Because it's pretty relatively easy to figure out. And right. Even this movie didn't bother me. I was surprised because usually I get annoyed by things like this. But even there's a moment where there's a big reveal where, like, the bad guy in the movie has this thing that basically proves their guilt. Right. And I always get annoyed in that when that happens. I always get really irritated. Like, why did they bother to keep that? And I wasn't bothered by that here because I just like the movie too much.
Right. And even the scene on the roof, like, if you weren't so invested, like, she goes from one roof to the other. She can't walk, mind you. And they skip right over that part. They show her from one roof to the other roof without even, and you get lost in it. It wasn't until later on, I'm like, wait, that was what I was wondering, how they're going to get past this part. And they just skip past it. And I didn't notice it in the moment. And that's how good they did with the intensity of this movie. Is anything that you'd question or dislike, like Sean said, they remove that from your head because you're so invested in the tension that it's really a really fun, watchable kind of thriller.
Yeah, I really like it. It's available on Hulu, so anybody can watch it. Anybody who's a subscriber to Hulu, it's available now.
Have you heard of this movie, Josh?
Yes, as of Sean's mentioning of it, I checked out the trailer and also was searching on Hulu yesterday and Netflix and HBO, all of these streaming services, to see if there was anything that I could fit in that would make sense for the show. And Run was right at the top of that. It does look very interesting to me. And the more and more I see Sarah Paulson, the more and more I am enjoying seeing her on screen.
Yeah, she's very good. Let's move on to Unhinged, starring Russell Crowe playing a young John Goodman. Am I wrong?
I mean, no, you're not wrong.
John Goodman 10 years ago would have been way better this role than Russell Crowe.
If anybody can make this work. Right. This movie is weirdly disappointing for me. So not that I didn't go into this movie with any expectations necessarily. I mean, I knew it was a B movie and it was a violent road rage thriller. I'd seen the trailer and so on. What disappointed me was this movie starts with a pre-credit sequence that is actually really, really good. When you analyze it from the perspective of film language, the way that they build this scene, it's Russell Crowe sitting in his truck, sweaty, desperate, angry, agitated. He's popping pills. He looks like distraught, filled with despair and anger mixing together. You don't know what's going to happen. He gets out of the truck. He goes in the back of the truck. He pulls out gas and a pickaxe, and he goes to the door of this suburban home. And immediately, you know from the visuals what's taking place here. There's a scene quickly of seeing a for sale sign, so you know this was probably his home. That's probably his wife inside with another man. Maybe we don't know that for sure. We're never told. It doesn't really matter. The point is that all these things are communicated visually and quite brilliantly in this 4-minute scene. And then immediately, so I stopped the movie at that point, right before the credits started to roll to open the movie, to write about this scene, because I was so inspired. Like, if the rest of the movie is this good, this is going to be a very good movie. Once I finished my article and put it to bed, I started the movie again, and immediately the credits just completely ruined the entire thing. Because watching this credit sequence was like watching Crash in fast forward. So stupid. And that leads into the rest of the movie, which is about a woman who honks at him in traffic, and he turns into Jason Voorhees. And it's like, oh, God, what a wasted opportunity. I mean, you follow this character, you stick with this guy in this moment, and maybe mix his story and her story together, and why give him more of a reason why he's doing what he's doing. You could have a pretty good movie here, especially based off of that opening sequence, which is so intriguing. And then they just piss it all away almost immediately.
Yeah, this is a good follow to Run, because what Run did well is what this does bad. This is an intense movie that you keep getting knocked out of because of the stupidity involved, or just or by the flaws in it. I mean, it should be Duel or Speed or something like that, but instead you have that opening scene that almost has nothing to do with the rest of the movie.
Yes, exactly.
And then two, the logic is flawed, so you keep getting knocked out of the movie, and you can't be wrapped up in the intensity like you are with Run, and that's where this one suffers. And Russell Crowe, I mean, God, he doesn't look good at all. Like, I'm worried for him. Like, I don't know. He's getting really fat, and maybe he's just doing it for the role, but it seems like she could outrun him pretty good a couple different times. I don't know. He's trying to be, I was going to say Jigsaw with road rage, because he's trying to teach her a lesson and make her a better person. But it's just, I don't know. It was kind of a disappointment, or not kind of, it was really disappointing and not quite forgettable disappointing. Like, it's going to be kind of like stick around. This is the type of movie I like to call, put towards the worst of the year list, because it should have been better.
Yeah, absolutely. It should have been
easier to call this shitty than like Chick Fight or whatever. Anything else on Unhinged before we move on? Are you going to watch it ever, Josh?
Probably not. And by the way, for those that are listening, this is not a biopic of a sweaty guy sitting in a car, angry, frustrated, fat. This is not a biopic on my life. Just because I am often unhinged does not mean that Russell Crowe is playing me in a film. Okay, I just wanted to get that. Thanks for it.
The 20th century.
The 20th century. This is an epically bizarre movie. I'm going to struggle to describe what this is. Director Dan Rankin has made a movie set in Canada in 1899. They're about to elect a brand new prime minister. There's this man who's been bred since his birth to be the next Canadian prime minister. It's been his life's goal. His mother has envisioned it to the point where she paints portraits of him with his who she believes will be his wife, this Nordic goddess who will be his wife and his first lady when he is the Canadian prime minister. And this woman actually exists. He actually meets her in real life, even though he's already got paintings of her on his wall. So it's weird. His name is William Lyon Mackenzie King. He's played by Dan Byrne. And basically, his mother, who is played by an actor named Louis Negan in drag, has predicted his entire life, decided that he's going to be the Canadian prime minister and who he's going to marry. But her predictions are they're off a little bit, because he doesn't really become every. He gets what he wants in the end, but not in the way you would want it. It's like kind of like a monkey's paw scenario for, be careful what you wish for. So the idea of how to become prime minister in this movie is you have to go through this series of games where you're competing with other men to become the Canadian prime minister by proving your patriotism, your loyalty, and your fortitude in a series of bizarre, increasingly bizarre games. All of this is set inside this partially CG universe that's created around them. There's some real sets, but then anytime they go outside, there's this like whole CG Canadian universe that they've created. And each town, each well-known town that they mentioned in Canada, has its own personality that is very strange. Vancouver is made up of fake grass and cut down trees. And another part is made up of just ice and mirrors. I don't know. It's so weird. The whole movie is very, very, very strange. But to become the Canadian prime minister and stay as the prime minister, he has to overcome his fetish for shoes. I don't know how to describe this, but the movie is kind of brilliant when you get down to it. It's got elements of David Lynch. It's got elements of it that look a lot like turn of the century movies. Like, I mean, the first movies made, the first silent films, like the German Expressionists or Trip to the Moon, George Méliès. Like, the look of this movie, even though it is in color and has CG, it also has this cinematography that look right at home on a classic, you know, hand-cranked movie machine. Like, it's that weird of a movie and that amazing of a technical feat. I love this movie. I don't know why. But I don't... It's not for everybody. It is not for everybody. If you don't like weirder flights of David Lynch, you're not going to enjoy this.
I heard a review that compared it to like a Terry Gilliam Monty Python like movie. Is that not accurate, or is it more?
That's fair. Lynch-y? That's a fair. Yeah.
Yeah, it looks weird. I'll give you that. It's right now.
I'll never look at a cactus the same way again.
And they show it in the trailer. I don't know. I mean, I'm using my imagination.
I can only tell you what I think the cactus is about, and just, even then I'm not sure, but it's striking.
I assumed he was going to sit on it or fillet it, one or the other. But I'm now just from the trailer.
I believe that you're trained to fight off sexual thoughts by thinking that your penis is a cactus.
Oh.
I believe that's what it's intended.
Gotcha. Like in terms of size or spikiness?
I would think the danger of touching it. I think they're getting to the danger of touching a cactus, the danger of touching your penis.
Once again, this is not a biopic.
Yeah, right now it's not available to stream. I think it's in like select cities. Hopefully it's out soon, though.
I can only imagine what the theatrical experience of this must be. Oh, by the way, Josh, this is a biopic, okay?
Just not of you.
Okay.
William Lyon Mackenzie King, former Prime Minister of Canada, is the real thing.
Okay. You definitely want to clarify things for me. I am, after all, the old boy connoisseur.
No, because, I mean, from that description, you would not think that's a biopic, but apparently it's intended to be in a weird way.
Is it as accurate as Ammonite?
Oh, yeah, I saw that you guys reviewed that one, too, and I read the synopsis of what you guys said, and Sean, I read your specific review of that, and boy, I couldn't have been more excited about two leads, but very interesting that your review stated otherwise.
Yeah, I was disappointed by that one.
I think that one comes out in a couple weeks on streaming, December 4th, I believe. Vanguard, Jackie Chan.
Yes, and this is Jackie Chan back in China, where he made his big debuts in movies like Rumble in the Bronx and Super Cop. Same director, in fact, working with the Stanley Tong, who directed those films, is directing this one, and it's very much in the vein of those movies: big, loud, ridiculous action scenes and over the top set pieces. Basically, Jackie Chan plays the head of a security company that works for high-end multi-millionaire clients. One of their clients is kidnapped initially, and they go in and they rescue him. And these big martial arts gun battles ensue. He has a secret that involves terrorists, and the terrorists decide to target his family after targeting him. And the whole Vanguard security team, led by Jackie Chan, has to go in and protect them. There are a bunch of major places where this goes. It starts in London, it goes to Africa, the Middle East, and eventually ends up in Dubai. And all of these places, just these big action scenes. And really, if you're a big fan of what Jackie Chan did back in the 90s, you're going to be a big fan of this. This is a solid recreation of that, to the point where even Jackie, even in his advanced age, is still doing a lot of really big stunts and really cool looking stunts. And I was impressed. I think the movie is rather nonsensical and very over the top, but I mean, if I'm somebody also who likes the Fast and the Furious movies, I can't be hard on this. This is kind of in that similar vein of just big dumb action, and I really and a better sense of humor too. It's got a really like that classically sort of Jackie Chan sense of humor. With that, I like Vanguard.
You into Jackie Chan movies like Rumble in the Bronx, Josh? I was never really a fan. Or I never really watched them, I should say. Not that I wasn't a fan.
Yeah, I never really watched them either. My exposure to Jackie Chan consisted of the Rush Hour films, which I have a reluctant appreciation for, ever so more reluctant after knowing who Brett Ratner turned out to be. but beyond that, it's just the Karate Kid remake and a couple of smaller appearances. I like Jackie Chan. I do. He seems like a very effusive, delightful guy. And I'm very impressed with what he's able to do and what I've read about what he's put his body through. But am I going crazy to seek out his films? No, not at all. We actually covered a movie of his when it turned 30. It was like his first American movie. I can't tell you what it is off the top of my head, but the striking part of it was how not different from any of his other performances that I've known about it was. Even though it was like 30 years ago at the time, it was still, oh, that's a Jackie Chan movie. Of course it is. He's not exactly what you'd call the best actor, and the action is ridiculous but fun. So it's a brand, and it can be very fun.
All right. Asylum, Twisted Horror and Fantasy Tales.
Yeah, this one's really... I mean, this one, if you thought the last one was weird, and 20th Century was weird, this one is equally as weird, but at least in the horror vein, it makes a little bit more sense. So there's a series of 9 stories being told by a man named Brendan, who is giving what he calls his final stand-up performance. He's dressed as a clown. He's a scary-looking dude. He's not funny in any way. he's giving his sort of performance, and each time he stops to tell a story, and each of these stories, I guess, plays into a long-running moral about his obsession with his girlfriend, which I guess plays out throughout. I kind of zoned out on a few of these, but some of these are very striking stories. One of them begins with this one about exorcisms, that basically it's an internet show about a priest who becomes very popular performing exorcisms that they stage, and they use special effects, and they've convinced a lot of people that what they're doing is real. But this time, an actual demon has gotten in there and is making it very, very, very real. And it plays out in a fashion that's really fun. It takes that premise and goes really well with it. And being that it's only about 10 minutes long, it doesn't overstay its welcome. And it's a really well-told, short film horror movie. I really like that. There's a couple of good ones in there, but there's only really that one and another one that stand out. The other one is this... South American story about a guy whose wife has decided that he's dying, and that he's going to die, and that he has to die because she's already begun to plan the funeral, and he's continually maintaining that he's fine. I'm not dead. I'm not dying. I'm fine. And she's like, no, we've already started the funeral. People are coming. You have to be dead. And so she goes through the motions of just making him at least pretend to be dead. And then when the people start to arrive, she's like, okay, we need to make you dead now. I know you're not dying, but you should have been dead by now, and you're not, so let's kill you. So she starts to kill him. And over again, she is just repeatedly stabbing and stabbing and stabbing him, and he won't die. It takes this perspective to the most ludicrous, violent, ridiculous degree that it goes around over the top and then back around to being not scary, but just shocking. And I really appreciated that. It's another one of these short stories that doesn't overstay its welcome. It's very entertaining while it's on, and just goes away at the perfect moment. And it ends on a moment of really terrific comedy, really dark, very disturbing, blood-soaked comedy. Those two are the only two that really stand out. I would actually see this movie just for those two, and maybe you might find the other ones interesting. I can't even recall them now. It's been over a week since I've seen the movie, and I can't actually recall the other ones. I can recall those two and they really stuck with me.
Well, yeah, that second one, the one where they're killing the husband, that one could be a Monty Python sketch. That's how fun. I mean, they're literally taking a mixer into his organs and blending them together, and he just won't die. It's blood everywhere. It's super gross, but like in a funny kind of way. It's not like, you know, one of those Japanese or Korean horror movies that it's just like Monty Python gore. It's
wonderfully absurd. Yeah.
Yeah. There is one sketch that I don't really remember the point of it. I just remember it was a bunch of, I guess, Hispanic people falling from the sky. And then all of a sudden you see the big wall and a Trump robot comes over and it starts killing all of them.
Oh, God, but yes.
I don't remember the point of it. I just remember him killing everybody.
That was weird. Yeah, I was kind of nodding off during that one.
Yeah. But the premise kind of caught my attention, but then you're right. It quickly lost me, so I started nodding off.
I think there was a Mexican wrestler who was going to take down the Trump robot, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, there was a desperado-like guy, and he pulls out the guitar case, and there's actually a guitar, and he's like, they gave me the wrong case. I mean, it was... But then it just kind of started. You're right. I mean, those are the two that you talked about that stood out to me. I watched it last night. That's why I remember the Trump one. But otherwise, I mean, it's, I guess you're right. I would watch it for those two because it's like a Monty Python movie. It's like The Meaning of Life, whatever. There's a couple sketches I remember and the rest of it's kind of, I just fast forward past it. But yeah, it's available right now. You can rent it on Amazon and Apple and wherever else you want. You rent your movies, iTunes. I guess it's the same thing as Apple. Let's
see. Josh, you intrigued?
Only once you said Trump robot. Because I started to think about Trump robot trying to come in and kill everyone. I mean, my God, let's not get this into the hands of a certain amount of people. That will be like their masturbatory fantasy.
Yeah. I think you'd enjoy the husband sketch if you're into Monty Python type things.
Absolutely. Once you said that, I was intrigued and understood exactly what you meant by ridiculous gore.
And then there's this movie trending right now. It came out in 2011. It's called Megan is Missing. I saw it on, you know, I would check the news every day, and I saw it pop up in the news. Why is this going viral on TikTok? And people are, little kids or my daughter's age or whatever, you know, early teenagers, you know, are taping themselves reacting to this movie. And so my daughter's like, can we watch this? And I was like, well, let me watch it first. It is a piece of shit. It sucks. The most disturbing part is the 12 and 13 year olds talking about blowjobs and stuff. That's the most disturbing part of this movie. When you get to the hostel like stuff at the end, hostel is way more effective than this is. The only thing that has going for it is like a found footage movie, so it looks real, and I think kids are falling for it. But we need to tell you what movies to go see instead of this. I mean, I would start with Hostel, work your way into shitty movies and kind of start there. Then maybe go to Saw. And then from there, you know, Cannibal Holocaust, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That's the movies you need to be watching if you want true horror. Martyrs is another good one. You know, Learn to Read, Audition. I'd let you try that one out. That's if you really want to record yourself reacting to movies, start there.
Yeah, we kind of recorded Zach reacting to Sallow.
Yeah, Sallow would be a good one. Maybe wait till you're 20 something for that one. And I haven't seen some. I'm sure Jeff could come up with, your cousin Jeff could, you know, there's other ones, Serbian film, I never seen that, and some other really fucked up shit.
But the only thing I've seen of Serbian film is I watched a guy react to it, and his reactions were enough for me.
Yeah, and I'm not opposed to, you know, I'm always up for a challenge, but I was really disappointed that Megan is Missing isn't even a challenge. And it's made by like the guy who works with Ryan Murphy in all those movies, so he's like a real director, a real person in Hollywood. And you know, he's given out these warnings: as soon as you see this date, turn it off, because that's when it starts to get scary. And no, it really doesn't. It's just it's like a half-ass hostel is really what it comes down to.
Yeah, somebody told me to Google photo number one, and I would get a sense of what this movie was like. And I didn't.
Go ahead. You'll be like, really? That's it?
All right, let's do a live reaction here to me Googling Megan is missing photo number one.
Yeah.
I'm curious now.
You've seen a lot of horror movies.
It's literally the number one. I don't get it.
I mean,
jeez, are you kidding me? Really?
And I get 12-year-olds being scared to death by it, but it's like, come on, it was the first 45 minutes of listening to them talk about sex being 12 was what really made it weird for me. And then going to parties and guys are saying, show your boobs. I mean, there's no nudity in it, nothing like that, but it's still the talk really made me uncomfortable. I'm sure kids talk like that, but I don't want to hear about it. So that was the most uncomfortable part for me. Not so much them dying at the end. Spoiler alert. All right.
Yeah, I would say watch Night of the Virgin and react to that.
Yeah, but again, work your way up. start with something that's not very good, but gory, and then get into those type of movies. All right, let's move on to our classic.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized undisputed classic.
Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles, a 1974 Mel Gibson parody, Mel Brooks parody of Western films starring Cleavon Little and Gene Wilder and Harvey Korman. A black sheriff is sent to the town of Rock Ridge, and they are horrified. And basically, it's just a lot of send-ups of really stupid racist people, which I just adore. I adore this movie. I love it so much. This is so much funnier than Young Frankenstein. It reminded me again why Mel Brooks is a genius. This is just so transgressive and hilarious and confident and ridiculous. And just, I mean, the performance by Cleavon Little is so strong. He is so charismatic and so funny in everything that he does. And then you have Gene Wilder, who, you know, I think most people have kind of a take on Gene Wilder where he's kind of nerdy and kind of awkward, and he's really, really cool in this movie, and it really works. I bought in. I did. I just love everything about this movie. I can quote this movie a lot. It's just so very, very funny. But of course, the reaction I want is yours, Bob, because you've never seen this before.
I had never seen it, and I don't want to say it was similar to Young Frankenstein. It was more of a, I watched it and I recognized that it was funny, but I didn't laugh kind of thing. Maybe it's because I live too close to Rock Ridge. I don't know. I mean, it's good. I don't know. I've seen so many movies like that I kind of know the joke before it's coming. And I mean, I thought the campfire scene in Dance with Wolves was funnier than the campfire scene where they're farting in this one. So it was good, but I don't know that I'll go back to it. I don't have any history with it, and I'm glad I can finally say I've seen it, but I didn't fall in love with it like I thought I would, if that makes any sense. Josh?
I saw this once 20 years ago when I was on a Mel Brooks kick, thinking that this guy has done more stuff other than Spaceballs. And so I went back and watched this and History of the World Part One. I didn't see Young Frankenstein, but I think I saw the producers as well. He's just like all comedy. There are brands, and Mel Brooks's brand in small doses, I'm very happy with. Blazing Saddles, I originally didn't like it. I think it's because I didn't understand the notoriety of it. And as a guy who's not necessarily easily offended, believe it or not, I was kind of like, this is really pushing the envelope here. And I was younger and didn't understand the inside jokes. And I'm still stupid, but less stupid now. And I get it. I watched about 55 minutes of this yesterday was unable to get to the rest of it because 4 hours of my day were occupied by another film. needless to say, I enjoyed it, what I saw a whole lot more this time around. What you said, Sean, about Cleavon Little and Gene Wilder is spot on. I was surprised that Gene Wilder could impress me as anyone other than goofy and awkward, but he totally is that here. By the way, speaking of Mel Gibson, I think he would feel right at home in part of this movie. So, hey, that's not a bad idea. But one thing that I specifically noticed when the credits were rolling, this has got six writers on it, okay? Mel Brooks being one of them. And then Richard Pryor is one of them as well. And that really makes a difference to me because when I look at it through the guise of Richard Pryor, I can see how all of these jokes would fit in with his routine. You know, he could be playing a character. He could be whatever Richard Pryor did on stage. It could fit right into this movie. That's what I really took away from it this time.
And before we get to, I like it. I'm glad I saw it. It's a good, funny movie. I was just hoping it was going to be one that I'm going to go back to time and time again. And I feel like I just by waiting so long, I kind of hurt that possibility, I guess, is all I was saying by slightly disappointed. I think it's really good. It's really funny. It just wasn't, it's not going to make me rewatch it over and over again is all I mean. So that's, as, it's not bad by any means. I don't want to get that impression out there.
You built it up too much for you?
What was that?
Was it built up too much for you?
Maybe. And again, it was still good. It was just more of the, you know, one, you've seen clips over the years because it is kind of a classic. So some of the stuff I'd already seen out of context. I do, again, it's good. I like it. It's just I was hoping, you know, for a movie that was going to make me watch it over and over again for here on out. And it hasn't become, it's probably not going to be that. But who knows, you know, maybe I'll, I don't know. I my wife doesn't like to rewatch movies, so that's not going to help either. but it is good. It is funny. I was expecting to, you know, have a movie I can watch once a year, if not more.
That like whole idea of going back.
Go ahead, Josh.
Okay. The idea of going back to this one, I didn't think that I ever would too. And then this time I noticed so many quotes throughout this movie that have been used in other areas of my life. My wife, who has apparently quoted this movie a lot, I picked up on a lot of what she said and was looking at her and saying, "Hey, you say that all the time," like authentic frontier gibberish. I thought that was very amusing. Now I know, of course, that it's not original of hers, which makes sense. She borrows a lot of material. But also the "excuse me while I whip this out." I've enjoyed that quote for some time and have used it for some time without even knowing where it came from.
I'm intrigued by when you've used this quote before.
Everyday life, Bob. Everyday life.
Sean, were you about to say something?
Just that I think there's some of this humor that obviously won't resonate for many people because it is out of date. Like references to Hedy Lamarr are not references that most people are going to get, you know,
right.
People probably aren't aware of who Hedy Lamarr was and why he thinks it's why he's so offended when people say his name is Hedy instead of Hedley. That's not going to play to a modern audience. And I understand that. So there's elements of this that obviously are going to be out of date. Comedy has the hardest time of sticking around for a long period of time because it does become dated or the types of humor, the way the humor is expressed, it becomes out of date. Like the use of the N-word repeatedly, you know, I'm not saying it couldn't be done today because I think anything can be made funny in the right context. It's just, it's not the same. It's not the same world. It's not the same worldview. And the things that were transgressive then are less transgressive now.
Right. Yeah, and then when you go with parody is even harder to last longer because this movie has definitely influenced a ton of other movies. So you've seen the trick, and because of that, it does affect people like me going back to watch one of the originals. So, and it's unfair. Anything else on Blazing Saddles before we move on?
No, really.
All right. Dances with Wolves, the long-awaited podcast. We've been talking about this for since Josh joined. Finally came.
Yes, Dances with Wolves stars Kevin Costner as Dunbar, a soldier from the North in the Civil War who gets sent out west to establish a foothold there. He finds a camp that is empty, and he's essentially the only one out there for months at a time when he finally meets the Sioux Indians and begins to build a relationship there, and eventually becomes so well ingrained in that culture that he becomes part of it, essentially. He meets a woman there, and they begin to fall in love and become a couple, and not a lot happens. This is just a series of things that just sort of proceed over 3 hours. And it's all fine. It's fine. There's nothing terribly wrong with this. This doesn't feel like anything interesting is happening if you're not like particularly invested in Kevin Costner. Right off that, this movie does a great deal of disservice to the character. There are a couple scenes like early on in this movie where they're going for black comedy. I'm not sure, but in his initial introduction is him on a horse trying to kill himself by getting shot during battle. And then he's proclaimed the bravest soldier we have. You got a real brave officer here, which, no, not really. He was trying to kill himself, but fine, sure. And I know, but it bugged me just how ridiculous that is. Then is one of the most bizarre encounters I've seen in a relatively straightforward movie. What direction was Maury Chaykin given to play that role? And why does this scene even exist? I mean, because his performance is so off key from the rest of the movie that it's like somebody mashing all the keys on a piano at once in the midst of a symphony. And you're just, what was that? And it's just so bizarre and so out there that really it just kind of, his character followed by then a character played by Robert Pastorelli only serve to make Costner look really, really boring. And that's not going to change once you get into the rest of the movie, because he's not going to do anything to be any more interesting. He's already been made to look very boring by these two extraordinarily broad performances that don't feel like they belong here. And I was so put off by those that I was just annoyed the rest of the movie. And we're talking about 3 hours of being annoyed the rest of this movie. And that's why I don't love Dances with Wolves. It's competent. It's filmed well. The activity in the movie makes sense. Even it's respectful. Even 30 years ago and 30 years later, it appears to be very respectful of the Native American characters within it. So I can't complain about those things, but I still can't. I can't get into this movie. It just doesn't do anything for me.
Before we throw it to Josh, I like the movie. I liken it to kind of a movie like Gladiator or Braveheart that's good but very simple. And, you know, it's worthy of being nominated, I suppose. But when you have a movie as a masterpiece like Goodfellas, that's where I kind of get annoyed at it. But the movie itself, I mean, I watched it, and it's a good movie. It's just really, really simple, and there's nothing wrong with simplicity at all. It's just my whole thing is Goodfellas came out this year. But the movie itself is, I think Costner's good. If anything, he just suffers from being Kevin Costner and being a baseball in his voice, the way he narrates. But that's more me. It's like me saying Tom Hanks shouldn't be Saving Private Ryan. It's that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'll throw it to Josh because I know Josh actually absolutely loves this movie.
Yes, I do. And what I really always care about when it comes to such vast differences in thought and opinion and care about stuff that we've talked about is honesty. And I appreciate that because it gives me different sides that I didn't even think about. But there's nothing inaccurate about what either of you said, actually, especially Sean, what you said about it being a little boring and it goes on perhaps a little too long. I say perhaps, you might say absolutely. And a character of John Dunbar that really doesn't have a whole lot of depth on the surface, okay? But Kevin Costner, I don't know, he doesn't always exhibit a lot of depth per se. I think that he's always been best in slightly comedic roles, be it Bull Durham or whatever the case may be. But here's the thing about this one. It's beautiful. It was one of, especially on Blu-ray, which is, this is the first time I've watched it on Blu-ray. I had a DVD previously, and there's just something absolutely gorgeous about watching this on a widescreen vista in its best possible form. Almost every scene, in fact. And it's impressive to me that Kevin Costner knew how to direct something like that, having not been an experienced director. So I have to give him props on that, especially like a lot of other first-time actors turned directors that you don't necessarily expect that something like this is going to come out of them. I would put Mel Gibson in that category too for Braveheart. Mm-hmm. You don't think that that's going to come out of him. And yes, there are a lot of things that happen over and over in this film or might not make sense in their own moments, such as the Robert Pastorelli scene or the Maury Chaykin scene. To me, that scene of Maury Chaykin just going off the rails was him representing some of the rest of the movie. Like, people weren't prepared at this time for what was going to happen. It was a very distressing time on the frontier. And then they clearly showed that the army wasn't necessarily supportive of these people that are doing this job on the frontier against a native peoples. So that made a little bit of sense to me. Does it make sense with the rest of the film? When you put it in the context that I did, yes, I didn't have a problem with it on my side. But the thing that I care about the most is the characters in this movie, be it anyone in the Sioux tribe, the chief, Graham Greene's holy man, or the supporting female characters, even the enemies like Wes Studi or some of the Union Army, they're so well fleshed out. And this movie almost needs the 4 hours that it takes to really flesh all these people out. I cared about all of them, even the enemies. And so I don't often get that out of a movie where I care about the results of what will happen to all of these people. And when certain people die in the movie, it mattered to me. Or if they were in danger, it really mattered to me. Gosh, the killing of Two Socks the Wolf was just heartbreaking. The death of the horse right before that was heartbreaking. And those are just animals. But to me, this represents what the frontier experience must have been like in a way. Dangerous, beautiful, aggressively racist, xenophobic, imperialistic, terrible on many fronts. And that kind of brutality and beauty, I just don't know of many films that offer that to me. And I compare that to Goodfellas, which I have, by the way, acknowledged that it is a really, really good movie. Okay, I didn't like it the first time I saw it because I wasn't prepared for that kind of brutality and gosh, people just being crappy to each other all the time. And that's where I really started to form my problem with mobsters, is that there just wasn't anything redeeming about them. But I know that Goodfellas is a great movie. This one, though, just offers so much more to me personally, and I think is a much better accomplishment film-wise, because you've got a rookie director doing this amazing, sprawling film with this incredible John Barry score and coaxing these performances out of all of these actors that we've not heard of before. That to me is way more an accomplishment than Martin Scorsese once again being great. So I've at least been able to include all that I wanted to say about this movie. Because I haven't shut up now for 5 minutes, but I hope that at least I've given you something else to think about.
No, definitely. I mean, I like this movie. I've seen it 5 or 6 times. I'm not opposed to even seeing it again. I'd probably watch it on a big screen, maybe. It is weird. Like, the first hour, a lot happens, and then, like, the next hour, it does slow down. But it's never boring, and you're right. What you're saying is true. It does look good. Unfortunately, it's not... I mean, we kind of live in the scenery that it's set in, I guess, a little north of that. But so it is a lot of plains and a lot of flatlands. The way he shoots it is very good. It looks very nice and very beautiful scenery. I get your point. It's impressive that a first-time director did really good. But still, when a master is a master, doing probably the best thing he's ever done, that's hard for me to go away from that.
Yeah. I love and respect you so much. Your passion just always affects me no matter what. Even though we do disagree on this movie, because I think for me, that there's just so much about this that is too much of a dad movie, and I'm not a dad. this is a movie that belongs to my dad. Like, this is the kind of movie that he could watch on the History Channel every day. Like, that's the kind of movie that Dances with Wolves is. And I think maybe from that perspective, maybe it works better. If you're a fan of the History Channel, then this is the movie for you.
See, this is the movie my mom liked more than my dad. Maybe it was because of the gratuitous nudity. I don't know.
You always have to show his ass.
That's a nice ass. I don't. I'd show it off if I
it's
had
the same thing. It's America's ass, dare I say.
It used to be.
The boomer.
That's Chris Evans.
Ass.
Don't you? Do not disparage Chris Evans's ass.
You're right. That is a better ass. I'd let that sit on my face. Okay. You know what, Bob? You were right. In that this, even though my dad did like this, my mom loved this movie. And this is a woman that didn't care about, you know, extended versions or special editions. And she went out and specifically bought the director's cut of this, the 4-hour version. And that's the first time, that's the first one that I saw in completeness, because I could never get through the 3-hour one piecemeal. Sorry, I just coughed, and hopefully you can edit that out.
That'd be fine.
So it was my mom's movie, and I understand exactly what you just said, Sean, though, like, it belongs to somebody else. And I'm watching it last night, I started to feel like, oh man, am I in that phase of my life where I start liking westerns all of the time in the afternoon? I am actually concerned about that now, because I was so overjoyed just watching this, and it does concern me that I'm going to move more towards that as a preference, as opposed to popping in Pulp Fiction every once in a while.
What does happen in that extra hour?
You know what, at this point I can't tell you, because I've seen the 4-hour version probably 7-8 times, and I've only seen the original once. But I mean, if neither of you guys watched the 4-hour version and you felt that it was dragging and boring a little bit, I do not recommend seeing the longer one.
I imagine he rides a horse for a while and he stares at the sun for a while.
And don't forget, the wolf comes around again a few more times. And
there's some bacon, and yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else on Dance with Wolves before we move on?
I am impressed with the amount of response I got. I posted this to Instagram, which posted it to Facebook, and the amount of response I got from people around our age saying that they did like it. Now, of course, my former father-in-law chimed in, who is over 60 years old, and he's in that category, and of course he loves it. But the fact is, there were a lot of people around our age that also chimed in or liked it or whatever, and that actually surprises me. I think you guys gave me this idea that everyone our age was really bored by this. So under the guise of the podcast, I'm biased towards a lot of things now.
I think a lot of people our age did like this movie because for 3 or 4 days of their high school life, this kept them from having to study history.
So they showed this in class sometimes? That would be awesome.
Yes, I think they probably did.
And I
was so much more progressive than Illinois.
And it's not fair because this is a better movie than the next three I'm going to mention, but you know, it suffers from that, what, Forrest Gump, Crash, and Driving Miss Daisy suffer for. So it was great movies that year that should have actually won the award instead of the... But this is actually a good movie compared to those other three, so...
Shoulda, coulda, woulda. The vote's over. There's no recount. Yeah,
this isn't a garbage movie.
No.
There's no garbage movie. This is not a garbage movie like Driving Miss Daisy is a garbage movie, or Forrest Gump is a garbage movie, or Crash. Those are garbage.
But the same things happened to all three of them, all four of them. Okay, the sequel to the greatest action movie ever made, Predator 2.
Yes!
Predator 2 stars Danny Glover as Lieutenant Harrigan. He's the head of a gang task force in Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, and I think it's 1997, is that right?
Sure.
That's correct.
And in 1997, Los Angeles gangs rule the streets, and it's like a war zone in Los Angeles. And he and his team are barely getting by, barely surviving amidst all this gang warfare. And into this comes the Predator. The Predator alien arrives, and the Predator alien has, what's his motivation again? Is it just that he sees violence and he wants to be part of it, or end it, or show that he's more violent than the violent people? I'm not sure what the motivation of the Predator is, but for some reason, the Predator just starts killing one gang and then the other gang and then the police and just anybody who then, not just anybody, that doesn't kill, just like he could just kill random people if he wanted to, but he doesn't. He just kills the people with guns, which I guess that maybe that's the greatest challenge. I don't know. That's a really big part of this movie that's missing, is any type of motivation for what the Predator does and why. But still, Danny Glover is so very, very good. He's very compelling. And I don't know why the Predator doesn't just end him the multiple chances that he has, but I'm glad he doesn't, because I like Danny Glover. And that's really the only thing I can say about Predator 2 is that I like Danny Glover.
Yeah, I'm pretty much on the same boat with you. It's kind of a clusterfuck of a movie, and that, you know, he really could have just wiped everybody out. The first one had the, you know, at least they were in the woods. There's only a few of them, and he's hunting them down. There's so many people in this movie. Just like, kill them all. What are you waiting for?
Right.
But, you know, it's an action movie, so it doesn't have to make sense. And you're right, Danny Glover is awesome. So it was
a lot of action too. I mean, this movie rarely slows down. It's got a great pace to it in terms of just the number of things that happen in succession. They just keep it moving and keep it moving, keep it moving. And for that, at least, it's fine. But yeah, it's a cluster. It's absolutely a cluster. Josh, do you have any idea?
Go ahead.
Josh, do you have any idea what the Predator's motivation was here?
Yeah, I think what the film is expecting is that anyone that comes into this movie understands the motivation from the first one. And it's not so much like, oh, he enjoys killing, or has to kill as many people as he can or whatever. The idea is that the streets are overrun by gangs, aka ruthless killers, and they're overcoming the cops, and there's this battle and who can be the best. Well, the Predators are all about proving themselves. So anytime a Predator comes to this planet or is dropped on another planet, it's a proving ground. And you can tell by the end of this film when all of, oh, spoiler alert, by the way, in case you haven't seen this 30 years later, when all of those predators show up, including the elder predator, they have this culture of proving oneself. And we're all familiar with that kind of trope. So I think going into this one, director Stephen Hopkins is expecting you to already know that. And if you don't, then yes, of course, the Predator's purpose here will be quite confusing. But I happen to think that this one is a little better than I ever gave it credit for when I was younger. And it, okay, it's not the best action movie of all time. It doesn't approach it, in fact, okay? But there is a frenetic pace to it, as you said. And it's very much a Los Angeles movie. Everyone is sweating. Danny Glover has never been more wet on screen than he is in this movie.
Have you seen Lethal Weapon 1?
I mentioned, like, the temperature has increased at this point in 1997. And, yeah, they were on to something. Who knew that Predator 2 was going to predict the future? But everyone is super distressed the whole time. It reminds me a little bit of cheesy 80s films or ones that are a little more hardcore, like To Live and Die in L.A. This really says a lot about what they thought the future was going to be like and that kind of dirty side of L.A. I've talked about. But there's a lot of fun in this one for me. Like, if it's not the super ridiculous gore of somebody's, you know, naked body hanging from the ceiling or whatever, if it's not voodoo gangs going against each other and being completely disgusting, if it's Gary Busey by himself is worth the admission on this one because of just how completely over the top he is in this. And if anyone remembers The Predator from a couple years ago, they had Jake Busey in that one playing the son of Gary Busey's actual character in this one. I find this to just be simply fun, and I don't take it too seriously now, and therefore it fits in a little better to the Predator lore. And I will say one thing about this. I find it preeminently responsible for the creation of the Alien versus Predator franchise because of the alien skull that is found on the ship at the end of the film. We managed to get now, oh, roughly 30 years of complete bullshit storylines for a wonderful franchise called Alien. And for that, I will never forgive Stephen Hopkins.
But what about the casting, though, of Bill Paxton? I mean, that's totally throwing off everything. He can't be in both franchises.
That's right. He cannot be both Hudson and whoever idiotic character he is here. You're right.
He was pretty much playing Hudson, Jerry. Wasn't he?
Pretty much. You know, it's weird. I don't know what happened. Like, I think something about Bill Paxton got into my head that he was always kind of the Titanic guy. But you watch his early career, and all of his performances are like this.
Yeah. Over the top and fun. Yeah, I mean, it. I don't know. To me, there was too much going on, so it was just kind of hard to follow. I just kind of got lost in it, and it was fine. But did anybody see Three Men and a Little Lady?
Good God, yep. No.
You've seen it, though, haven't you, or no? You've never seen it?
Like 30 years ago, I saw it.
Oh. You didn't watch it this week, did you, Josh?
Go ahead, guys.
Oh, no, I didn't watch it this week. But, I mean, I remember being excited about there being a sequel to this because I was young and my parents were way more excited about it than me. But even I at 11 years of age recognized that it was bullshit and awful. And anything that you liked about the first one was completely diminished by this one. Over cute, unnecessary.
And who knows?
Cash grab.
Yes.
Just a straight up paycheck grab. For each of these guys,
they should have done another ghost thing in it, but they failed. And who knows what the Nutcracker Prince is about?
I'm sure it's the Nutcracker story. I guess the set up the Nutcracker thing that actually cracks nuts.
An adaptation of the classic tale of a girl's dream turned reality when her new toy turns out to be a young man placed under a curse, starring Kiefer Sutherland.
That's a disturbing premise.
It is animated. That is our show. Go ahead.
What if you had a toy and it was Kiefer Sutherland and it came to life in your daughter's bedroom? I'm just saying, that's creepy.
You know, there is a Kiefer Sutherland toy out there made by the Nika company for the Lost Boys franchise. So if you really want a Kiefer Sutherland figure, go right ahead.
I got to imagine another 24 toy somewhere at some point. That is our show. Next week, we've got Fat Man, Hillbilly Elegy, Happiest Season, Uncle Frank, Black Beauty. All these are on like Disney Plus, Netflix, Amazon. Fat Man will probably have to rent. I think Sean's already seen it. I wasn't going to let him talk about it without me watching it to defend. I read his review. We haven't thought about a classic yet, but in 1990, Misery turned 30. Hidden Agenda, Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, and Descending Angel was a show on HBO, a movie. I don't know if that's worth talking about or not.
I can't say sure what we're going to do yet for a classic, but Mr. and Mrs. Bridge, I believe, is Paul Newman, so that might be a way to go.
Just as an FYI, I watched Misery as part of the films over the past few months that I've gone through because my son and I read the book together as a part of our book club that we're having, and he really wanted to watch that. And I know that it's next week that you're talking about it, but I liked it. That's all.
You're more than welcome to come back if you want. You've got nothing else.
I don't know if you want me to just talk about that. There's not enough to talk about. It's not as good as the book.
Oh, hooey.
Oh, and Kathy Bates is overrated, and she deserved the Oscar for Primary Colors instead.
Wow.
Hot takes. He's spitting bars here, people.
Yeah. Hot fire, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow. I thought this was a little better than Dancing with Wolves. I'll have to go back and rewatch this. Maybe my memory's wrong. All right, but that is our show. We will have a Patreon episode out for Thanksgiving, so be sure to subscribe if you want to hear that. Otherwise, it'll come out to the regular listeners later on. Our T Public page on ihatecritics.net, it's up in the right-hand corner, or just go to tpublic.com and search Critics Pod. And don't forget to follow us on all of our social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. Our handle is Critics Pod. And we've given away digital downloads of Echo. What was it called again? Echo Booming?
Echo Boomer.
Boomer.
Echo Boomer.
Echo Boomers.
Michael Shannon, yes. And Patrick Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, so look for that this week. Let's do a quick round of Flick Sharp before we get to our record our bonus episode that everybody's gonna have to pay to hear. Clueless Magnolia.
That's tough, actually, because I love both of those movies.
Very easy for me.
Magnolia.
Magnolia.
Clueless. 48 Hours, Meet the Fockers.
Forty-eight Hours is a bit of a disappointment. Recently, Meet the Fockers though isn't very good. 48 Hours.
I'll go with that too. Just the Eddie Murphy factor. It is disappointing. I agree with that.
I like Meet the Fockers. So I'd go with that one. Find Me Guilty, 2006. The Da Vinci Code, 2006.
Oof, man. Jeez, and I'm never going to sit down and watch The Da Vinci Code again. I wouldn't want to watch Find Me Guilty, but it's shorter than The Da Vinci Code. And Vin Diesel's actually not terrible at it, so I'll go with that one.
I will also go with Find Me Guilty. Fuck The Da Vinci Code.
I'll go with The Da Vinci Code, but not proudly. Little Shop of Horrors, 13 going on 30.
13 going on 30.
I'll take Little Shop of Horrors.
I think I'll go with 13.
Amanda doesn't like musicals.
Yeah, I don't. And that's one of the ones, though, that I could probably quote back to front because it was on HBO all the time in the 80s. And we also have a plant in this house called Audrey 2. So, hey, why not?
I'll go with 13 going on 30. Naked Gun, 33 and a third, While You Were Sleeping.
Jeez, I don't know. pick your vanilla poison here. Naked Gun, I guess.
I'll go with Naked Gun. Anna Nicole Smith's performance, and that was just outstanding.
I'll go with While You Were Sleeping. Superbad Traffic.
Superbad.
Oh, gosh. I'm actually going to go Traffic, but it's not as close. It's closer than you would think coming from me, because Traffic is actually pretty overrated now that I think about it.
I'm going to go with Superbad. Housebound, 2014. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, The Secret of the Ooze.
I don't remember Housebound, honestly.
Right. Neither do I.
I'll refresh it. Clueless, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, Secret of the Ooze.
Clueless. Clueless. It would be close, though. If it was the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from 1990, it would be very close.
I agree with that. Really, I'll pick Clueless over Vanilla Ice any day.
Yes. Apocalypse Now, Holiday, 1938.
I don't think I've seen Holiday 1938.
Neither have I.
All right. Faces of Death is not a movie. Apocalypse Now, Patch Adams.